Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Tuesday, July 14th. I'm Ray Graff. On today's show, we talk about intellectual property. It's the Copyright Forum. And joining us on the line today, Paul Rapp and Polly Law. They are here to answer your questions about protecting your writing, your music, your art. If you have a question about copyright law or maybe what's in the public domain, maybe you have a question about fair use, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email your questions to voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Paul Rapp, Polly Law, your copyright calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today's show is the Copyright Forum. And to answer your questions, a great panel of two. Paul Rapp is here. Paul is an intellectual property lawyer and writer. He represents musicians, writers, fine artists, businesses involved in the creative economy. I wonder if he represents mimes. We're going to look into that. He lectures widely on intellectual property issues. Once a long time ago, he wrote a column for a long-dead publication called Metroland. Polly Law is a past president of the Graphic Artists Guild, an organization focused on the rights of artists. She is a designer, illustrator, and artist whose works are in numerous private collections and is represented by galleries in Rhinebeck, New York, along with Provincetown and Nantucket, Massachusetts. You got a question about intellectual property? Give us a call. 800-348-2551 is the number, 1-800-348-2551, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Paul Rapp and Polly Law, welcome back to the show.
Hey, thanks for having us.
Great to have
you. How are you, Ray?
Good. Everybody healthy?
Yeah.
Yeah? Bored?
I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah, well. Well, we won't be putting a stop to that for the next hour, but we'll do the best we can. Why don't we start the show with a couple of emails that came in prior to showtime, and then we'll get rolling on the phones. The number is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. This came in from Mike in Saratoga, and Mike writes, I have created some drawings. Well, first of all, he says, hello, esteemed panel. So we'll see if you can live up to that.
Hello, Mike.
I have created some drawings, put them together with some slogans. I plan to put these on T-shirts, hats, etc. I imagine my original drawings can be protected intellectual property, but what about the slogan that would appear below the artwork? What about the combination of both? And that is from Mike.
Are you incorporating the slogan into the artwork? I mean, physically incorporating it? Or is it, you know, that's, I think, an important thing to look at.
So what do you mean? Like, if you did that iconic word love from the late 60s, which was in a shape, that might be okay. But if it's just a phrase underneath an image, it might not be protected?
It might not be protectable.
Interesting.
Yeah, it might not be. I mean, a short phrase is not going to be protectable by copyright. The design will be if it's fairly elaborate, and if you have a fairly elaborate design and the phrase together, and like Polly said, you know, incorporated into the design, then you might be able to protect that. But the Copyright Office can be really, really squirrely about these things, and so you know, I can't guarantee from one day to the next what they're going to approve and what they're not going to approve.
I mean, does it depend on who actually is looking at your material? I mean, are there easy judges and hard judges?
Well, they're anonymous judges.
Right.
You can't really tell who. But, you know, there's a lot of wiggle room in copyright law. So, you know, the examiners have a hard job sometimes figuring out what is beyond the pale and what is within the pale of copyright.
Hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and on the first level, when you send things in, both to the Patent and Trademark Office and to the Copyright Office, you're dealing with a fairly low-level civil servant. You're talking, you know, you may be talking to somebody who's just out of college or an examiner, just out of a trademark examiner, just out of law school, And they have guidelines that they follow, and they have supervisors that look over their shoulders, but you still get kind of an unnerving range of responses from them. You know, I'm dealing with one right now with a trademark issue with a word that I can't even say on the radio.
Oh, thank you for not saying it for a change. Appreciate it.
You know, it's hard because I've just been looking at this word and on dozens and dozens and dozens of other trademark applications, some of which are granted and some of which aren't, and they can't seem to figure out why. Well, I mean, they know they don't want to register anything with this word, but the Supreme Court has told them they have to. So now they're coming up with other reasons. And it's just, you know, you can try and good luck to you. But, you know, sometimes with T-shirts with word marks, I tell the client, you've actually got to start a company called, you know, whatever your word mark is, because then you can start talking about trademark rights because you have a company called. You have a company called, you know, the world is a wonderful place.
Yeah. Which would,
but, you know,
and the T-shirt that says, you know, but that's like jumping through hoops for no reason. I mean, it's just kind of silly.
Yeah. But if Mike can, you know, make a thread the slogan through the drawing somehow so that they're inseparable.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Then he stands a better chance.
Well, what
but
about?
Then again, someone could still copy the slogan, the words, just not the design.
I mean, what about the shirts we saw in the 70s? Keep on trucking. I mean, that must have been protected, right?
Well, it was R. Crum, and everyone stole from him.
Yeah, but he hand lettered those. He that's a hand-lettered font, which would help also.
Interesting. All right, this one more email, then we'll take a break, and then we'll hit the phones. 1-800-348-2551 is the number. Poly Law is here. Well, not here. They're here on the radio, but they're not in the studio. We are social distancing, apparently, until the end of time. Paul Rapp is also here on the line. Our number is 800-348-2551. This email from Aaron, and then we'll take a break. Aaron writes, I'm writing a book and planning to relate my story to the lyrics of songs that mean a lot to me and the story I'm writing. Would I need to get permission from the artist in order to use their lyrics in my book?
Ooh, good question. I come up to this all the time. I'm without seeing the book, from what you describe, you're sort of using the lyrics as a jumping off point for something else, and it sounds to me like it really could be fair use, that you wouldn't have to get permission. You know, then again, you know, you may run in, it could be considered a derivative work, which is a work that's a direct takeoff of the original. So I would really have to look at it, which would not be a good idea.
Interesting.
And music publishers, and the problem with this often is, you know, music publishers really don't think fair use is anything and may try to exert some leverage. I mean, my rule of thumb is if you're using song lyrics like window dressing, like, say, Stephen King does at the beginning of every chapter where he'll start
epigram,
a chapter with a lyric, that's something you should probably get, you know, you should get permission
really
for. But
even if it's a line, I mean, I can see if it's the whole song. Like if you did the whole lyrics to The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, that's a whole book. I understand that. But if you're just taking a line from a song and putting it at the top of a chapter,
if you're throwing in on the shores of Lake Gitche-Gumee, you could probably get away with it. Gordon Lightfoot probably won't come out.
No. Well, thankfully, I'm not doing that. So,
yeah, if you're using a line that is immediately recognizable as being part of this song, you know, that is iconic for the song.
Yeah,
you probably need to clear it.
Okay. Tell you what, let's take a break here, and then we'll get to the phones. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's the Copyright Forum. 800-348-2551. Paul Rapp, Poly Law. Your call's coming up. Thank you. Vox Pop, the Copyright Forum, 800-348-2551 is the number. Hey, Paul Rapp, you hear that music?
Yeah, what was that?
Okay,
that was good.
That's some mutual friends of ours. That's Art Bernstein on drums and Chuck DeLoya on guitar. That's pretty good, huh?
Oh!
Yeah.
Wow!
Not bad, not bad.
Yeah.
It is the
I love those guys.
Oh, yeah. It is the Copyright Forum. Paul Rapp is here. Polly Law is here. If you have a copyright question at all, any intellectual property question, give us a shout. 800-348-2551 is the number. Marta is in Cooperstown. Marta, you're on.
Maestro, you always have the best bumpers.
Oh, yeah.
I'm calling today not so much to protect my rights, but not to infringe on somebody else's. My parents brought over a bunch of children's books when they came here from Poland. The books are from the 20s, and I've also been collecting old cookbooks and kind of the handouts that old appliance companies and stuff would do, which have also fantastic graphics. I'd like to use those graphics. In many cases, the company doesn't exist. It wasn't a big publisher. What do I need to do to try to track down to see if, you know, who does hold the copyright, if anyone?
Well, whatever you do, you need to keep a record of what you've been doing. So that
in other words, if
things happen and someone says, well, I own the copyright to that, you can say, well, here are the steps I took.
A record of my attempts.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, anything that was originally published before 1925 is going to be in the public domain, and you can just use it.
Is that worldwide or just the U.S.?
That's just the U.S., but it's also the outer limit. Other places, you know, other countries may have a later date, but I don't think any countries are going to have an earlier date.
Under the Berne Convention?
Say it again, Polly.
Wouldn't the date come under the Berne Convention for the Polish pieces?
I don't know the answer to that, and especially since Poland spent a period of time as a communist country in which who knows what their copyright protection
The books are pre-Soviet, but the Soviets were there a long time.
Yeah.
So, I don't know the answer to that, but like Polly said, you know, try to research who might own these things. Keep track of how you're searching and what you've searched, because chances are, you know, you're not really going to find anybody.
That's
good. At which point, I would recommend just going ahead and using the stuff as you see fit. And if somebody pops up and says, oh, we own that, which is highly unlikely, it sounds like to me. But if somebody pops up, you can say, well, I went looking for you, and this is everything that I did, and where were you? And at which point, you know, you're certainly not guilty of anything like a willful infringement. You tried to find somebody to ask permission, and you couldn't.
Yeah.
Thanks so much.
This brings up something interesting to me, at least. You know, especially for the illustration cuts for the appliance manuals. What if, say, Getty owns, you know, thinks that they own the rights to those illustrations?
Right.
Because they put them in their catalog.
Huh.
Well, then, you know, Getty will, might send one of their little minions chasing after you, you know, and there's like a couple of law firms which are really kind of the bottom of the barrel of the practice of law, if you ask me.
Yeah.
And they chase around people on behalf of Getty, looking for low hanging fruit.
You know, go ahead.
You can generally, unless what you've done is really craven, you know, and obviously an awful infringement, you can feel free to ignore these guys because they're not going to do what it takes to go to court to sue you.
Hmm.
Or you offer them one-tenth of what they're demanding, and they'll probably take it and then go away.
You know, Paul, you're an intellectual property lawyer, and you speak of these minions with derision, but don't they provide you with a tremendous number of billable hours in the long run?
No. No, not yet. Usually I get a call from somebody who's totally freaked out. And then And I say, well, just ignore it. And they say, thank you, and hang up.
Oh, pro bono.
It's almost like my life 24/7 is just doing Vox Pop.
Oh, my God. I think that was a shot.
People call me and ask questions, and they say, thank you, and hang up. And I'm like, huh.
Very interesting.
Glad I helped somebody.
Well, you could do what you did today. Just don't answer the phone. Our number here is 800-3. You know, we tried to get a hold of Paul on the line. He said, you know what? I don't know who these freaks are. I'm not picking the phone up. He finally did before the show. It's all good. 800-348-2551. If you'd like to talk to Paul and Polly, Mike is in Niskayuna. Mike, you're on.
Hi. Is a mathematical formula or algorithm patentable, or if you'd be protected? It might be even a business method. And for example, if Pythagoras presented a squared plus b squared equals c squared, could he protect that now?
No, I mean that it certainly isn't protected. It certainly isn't protected via copyright.
If that were a new formula today, presented today,
you might be able to try a patent. You know, business methods. And it's controversial, and maybe they should be or maybe they shouldn't be protected, but it might be possible to get a patent for that. You would have to talk to a patent lawyer about that. I tend to think not, but if you have a particularly crafty patent lawyer, maybe he can sneak it through for you.
Good enough. Okay, thank you.
Thanks. But even if he sneaks it through, does it make the next level if some major corporation uses it and says, well, you know what, this is not patentable?
And that's what my next statement was. I mean, the thing about getting a patent is once you have it, you have to defend it if somebody, infringes. You have to. And that gets, and you know, patents are expensive to begin with. I mean, we're talking $10,000 and up. And then once you have it, then you have this burden to protect your patent, and that can cost tens of hundreds of thousands of dollars. Hmm. So, you know, careful what you wish for.
Polly Law is here. Paul Rapp is here. It's the Copyright Forum on WAMC Vox Pop, 800-348-2551, the number. And Samantha is in Tivoli. You're on, Samantha.
Oh, thank you. It's a two-parter. The first, I took some photos of a somewhat famous person in a public venue of them dancing. Do I have to get a release if I want to paint them or do drawings from the photos that I took? Does anybody know?
No.
That's good.
You would have to get permission if you wanted to put your drawings or the photograph on T-shirts or posters. But if they're in a public place dancing, you have the right to take their picture, and you have the right to use that picture in a non-advertising kind of format. And you also, I think, have the right to make a painting or a drawing based on the picture.
And can I copyright the painting or the drawing?
Right. But, you know, making copies, coming up with putting it on lunchboxes or hats.
I'm talking about, it's called giclée. It means spraying ink on a canvas. So it looks like an original, but it isn't. It's actually a copy of your original.
Well, you wouldn't want to do a mass market with something like that. You could do numbered. Excuse my dogs, the plumbers here. You could do.
Talk about billable hours.
Numbered. How much numbers would it be? Like
I would have to look.
10, 1 to 50, 1 to 100.
Oh, I see what you're saying. How many could you do with signed and numbered? Copy.
Exactly.
I would have to look. There's a state law that addresses this, and I don't know what that number is. It's certainly not 1,000, and it's certainly more than 10.
I wouldn't think it would be anything. I would assume it's 100 or less.
Hmm. That's what I'm thinking, but without taking a look at the law, I can't advise you.
So I guess
where would I be able to find that law? How would I look it up on the internet?
It is, what is that area of law? It's a section of New York State law and the name of it.
Maybe it'll come back to you later on in the program.
Maybe it will.
Yeah.
And then I can tell you.
All right. Well,
can I ask?
Cultural affairs.
Two more questions.
It's the cultural affairs law, and it has to do with numbered prints.
And cultural affairs. Now, I think the answer to my next question is no, but does a U.S. copyright in any way protect you from being ripped off internationally?
No.
Yes.
Oh, well, we got two answers there.
We have a conflict.
Let me get the magic eight ball. I'll settle this.
Okay.
I mean, only if the infringement took place in the United States, right?
No, that's the Berne Convention again. If you're registered here, if you're registered here, you're covered all over the world.
But enforcing it's the tricky part, right, Paul?
Enforcing it's the tricky part, especially if the ripoff happens in China, then, best of luck.
Well, the reason I ask is Steven Spielberg did DreamWorks, but he did a U.S. copyright and he also did an international copyright.
Ah.
See, that's why it's tricky.
Hmm. Any ideas, Paul, before?
He shouldn't have to do that. You may be talking about trademark. He would have had to have trademarks.
I think you're right.
Yeah.
Okay. And one last question, if I can squeeze it in.
I suppose.
How many paintings or artworks can you put on the under the one umbrella for making a payment to the copyright office? It used to be like 35. I don't know what it is now.
It's now 10.
That's
what I
thought.
It used to be virtually unlimited, but they've just, right, Polly, it's 10?
Yeah.
Photographs have a huge number.
Okay.
Thank you so much for your time.
But
all right, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
It used to be 150, and now it's 10?
Well, they got to pay those examiners.
All right, I suppose so. Polly Law is here. Paul Rapp is here. It's the Copyright Forum on WAMC Vox Pop, 800-348-2551. The number, Nancy and Rhinebeck. Nancy.
Hello,
Nancy.
Thank you for taking my call.
Oh, you're welcome.
I am a retired teacher. I taught for many, many years. Loved it. Now I substitute. And I've written a half a dozen children's stories. One of them in particular that I'm really fond of is written in a way that helps young children write their numbers, but it's written in rhyme. And I think that years and years ago, I might have seen books like this, stories, written in rhyme, and I may have seen this one. What do I have to worry about the fact that maybe it's already been written or expressed the way I did, but I use my own, expressions in writing it.
Well, just the format of writing a rhyming story can't be exclusive to anyone.
Right.
Correct.
And you could try doing a Google's or a search engine search of one of the distinctive phrases from your book just to see if anyone else, if by some off chance you remembered something from your childhood and use that.
Well,
but
childhood, this is from when I first started teaching. I taught for 35 years.
Okay.
I remember seeing something very similar. But I tried to add my own twist to it. I just don't want to get into trouble, but I really like the story.
Doing a rhyming story can't be exclusive to anyone.
Right. Yeah, and even the format. I mean, you would have to have an awfully good memory to copy enough of it closely enough that you wind up infringing.
Well, George Harrison did, right?
I was in a band called Blotto that had a song called I Want to Be a Lifeguard.
Yes.
It was very popular about 40 years ago.
Yep.
And at some point, like in the late 80s, the guy who wrote the song, Broadway Blotto, was cleaning out his parents' house, and he found a yellow 45 RPM record with, on the A side, it was Popeye the Sailor Man.
Yeah.
And on the B side, it was a song called I Want to Be a Lifeguard.
Oh!
It appeared in a Popeye cartoon in like 1938.
Different song though,
and
right?
Broadway's standing there looking at it going, oh my God. But, and there was a Popeye episode called I Want to Be a Lifeguard with a whole big routine.
Yeah, but you can't copyright a title.
And thank God the melodies were, very different, and the lyrics.
All right. Well, Nancy, thanks for that call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's the Copyright Forum today with Polly Law at Paul Rapp, and looks like Pat in Saratoga. Pat, you're on.
Hi. I want to apologize. I'm in a thunderstorm, so I hope you can hear me.
Oh, boy.
Ooh.
So far, okay. So good.
Okay. So I'm in the process of putting up a website, an artist website, and I don't know the particulars about posting original artwork. I mean, what happens with the fact that your artwork's online, it's on your site, but it's not in any way protected at that point.
There are a couple things you can do. One is you have to make a decision. Well, I mean, things may have changed, but as far as I know, if you do not want your work to be accessible for people who use Pinterest, you need to put in the meta information at the in your coding a tag that says no pin. And that will keep, you know, Pinterest will not be able to show your work.
Huh.
And
I didn't know that.
Yeah. And, well, this information is back from when Pinterest first started, so maybe it doesn't apply anymore. I have not kept up with, I mean, my own website is so damnably out of date that you know. Anyway, also, you know, you have to weigh your chances of your artwork being listed. Now, the good thing is that it will be reproduced at 72 DPI on the web, which is you can't print from that. You can't really lift a piece to print from at 72 DPI. It needs to be 300 or more. So that kind of protects your work, but it doesn't mean it cannot be lifted to be used on someone else's website. What I do is I watermark my work. I put a very faded out line of my copyright notice on the piece, in the piece, you know, right across it, not politely down in the corner where it could be cropped out. This is like right across the middle. And it is grayed out enough that it is visible, but it does not interfere with the image itself overly.
Okay.
So that's what I do.
Well, Pat, we have to take a break, but thank you. Go ahead, Paul.
And, you know, if you're putting something online for the whole world to see, I would recommend registering the copyright with the Copyright Office.
Okay.
You know, and then, you know, talk to the artist and or if you're the artist, I mean, just think about how much do you want this shared? Is it going to bother you to have somebody on Facebook go, oh, my God, look at this great painting. This artist is phenomenal. Mm. And to post the painting, which is going to, you know, drive traffic to your site and create interest. I mean, you have to, you know, like come up with your own personal decision on how much sharing you're willing to tolerate, because, you know, not all of it is bad. So there you go.
By the way, our last caller was in Saratoga in the middle of a thunderstorm. The National Weather Service has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for Albany, Rensselaer, Schenectady, and Saratoga until 3:19. That is a severe thunderstorm warning for Albany, Rensselaer, Saratoga, and Schenectady until 3:19 p.m. And, of course, you'll find your latest weather news here at WAMC or something like that. It's the Vox Pop Copyright Forum. And we've only just begun. Well, sort of. We'll be done in 20 minutes, but we're coming back. It's Vox Pop on WAMC. Ray Graff here. It's the Copyright Forum today. We're joined by Polly Law and Paul Rapp. If you have an intellectual property question, give us a call quickly, 800-348-2551. We will do our best to get through all of the calls. This email came in from somebody by the name of Stephen. That's right. It's way at the bottom in a small font. Stephen writes, I work at a public access TV station. I'm curious what advice you give people producing videos. Usually in our case, it involves nonprofit organizations. You mentioned there's a lot of wiggle room in copyright law. We often have video submissions that include clips of popular commercial music, either as bumpers or as background audio during portions of the program. YouTube will immediately advise that there is a potential copyright violation. It provides instructions that you are probably okay unless your program starts to make money, in which case they indicate they will get back to you. What's your advice on what on online? Hang on. What's your advice on that online use of other people's music, and what's your advice on using it for regular cable TV broadcasts?
For TV, you're definitely going to need permission. You know, everyone wants to use the latest hits or some classic rock music, but the fact is, those are very valuable properties to the music publishing companies and the record companies. They make that's where they make the bulk of their money is in the from their catalog, yeah. And they police very strictly the use of their music. You know, if you're on YouTube, oftentimes you'll get you'll have the work taken down.
Right.
If you've got popular music on it on cable television, don't use it unless you've got permission.
Okay.
I mean, the alternative is every town has got musicians, and we're listening to some during the break here.
Yep.
Who are making world-class music that will fit into your program just as well as a song by Tom Petty or, you know, Billie Eilish or whoever. And,
yeah.
And you know, find a local musician, say, can I use this? And chances are they're going to say yes. So
and give them credit.
Use that. And, you know, yeah, tell them you'll give them credit and hyperlinks and all the rest. The other thing I'll mention is for stuff on YouTube, it really depends on the record company and the publishing company who own the rights to the music you're using. I had a client who's a fairly prominent local musician who did one of these quarantine split screen Zoom.
Oh, yeah.
He did a cover version of a hit from the 80s that was huge. And we're scrambling around trying to get the rights, and we're not getting any kind of response because nobody's in their office. And I said, just put it up and see what happens. And they put it up, and the next day it was still up, but it had a little advertisement in the front of it. And so what happens is the rights holders can tag a video with their music on it to make money, you know, if they liked. And it was basically an endorsement of this cover version of this song.
Well, that's pretty cool, actually.
By the music publisher. Yeah. You know, because it's no skin off the back of my clients, and
right.
The songwriter's getting paid.
All right, this is from Steven, and then we'll go back to the phone. Steven writes, I've written 60 songs over the last 40 years, and I'm finally going into the studio to record a CD of several of them. What is the simplest way to copyright these songs? And that's from Steven.
You go to copyright.gov. And submit the audio file, don't you?
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah. Open an account. I'm told. I complain, and I've been doing that every time, every show we're on. I complain about the copyright.gov website and how hard it is.
Yeah.
But I'm told there are video tutorials that they have there that you can just watch, and it tells you how to do your application.
Okay.
And I've had a couple of clients tell me that it's wonderful. You know, they do that and they just, it's a snap to register their work. So, and you can do it yourself, or you can hire somebody to do it for you.
Now, in the case of Steven, he's going to record a bunch of his songs, probably not 60, unless he wants to do a 4-album set right away. But supposing he gets halfway done, he's got the demos, the forms are set, he's got the basics of the, you know, scratch vocals on it or whatever. Can he submit that and then have it copyrighted even if he further adorns it and further polishes it up and gets it ready for release?
Yes, but I would, you know, give them the best version possible. You know, if you're not quite done yet, wait till you're done,
okay.
You know, because you're not releasing anything other than maybe playing it for a few friends.
All
so.
Right.
Rather than jump the gun, wait till it's as close to, you know, I mean, final mix pre-mastering, it, you know, would be a fine time.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Paul Rapp is here, Polly Law as well. Catherine is in Woodstock. Catherine.
Hi there. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
There is a movie that came out in the 40s, which I would like to try adapting into a musical. Now, I looked on Wikipedia, and they said, oh, it's in the public domain because they forgot to renew it. My agent says, do not trust Wikipedia. So I have contacted the copyright office, and they have never gotten back to me. How can I proceed? Because I clearly don't want to spend, you know, a couple of years of my life and working with my composer to put this together if it's not going to be, you know, if we ever have theater again in my lifetime.
Oh, we will. Well, faith.
I mean, Wikipedia is generally pretty accurate, especially on stuff like this. But, you know, you could double check, you know, you can, I mean, the copyright office will not tell you, but if you find someone who wants to do the research, and it can mostly be done online, the copyright office online records only go back to about 76, but Stanford University has an online database of all of the copyright renewals going all the way back to, you know, 1919. For those of you, it used to be before the mid-70s, you could register a copyright, you'd get it for 28 years, and then after 28 years, you could renew it.
Right.
That doesn't happen anymore. Now you have a copyright for your life plus whatever, 70 years, and there's no renewal. But for something in the 40s, renewal was required. So it's just a matter, I think, of hiring somebody to go in and dig and confirm that there was no renewal. And then off you go. And if the studio that originally did the movie, I mean, you could contact them and say, is it true this is really in the public domain? And they'll probably be truthful. I mean, I can't imagine them going, oh, no, you need a license when you, in fact, don't.
No, wait, but Paul, what if she calls the studio and says, is this in the public domain? And they say, oh, let's get back to you. And then they put it out of the public. They recopyright
it. They can't.
No.
Ooh, that's okay. Very cool. My agent, though, said that screenplays are in copyright for perpetuity. Is that fallacious?
No.
Time for a new agent.
No. I wasn't going to say it, but no, it's not in perpetuity. It's going to be for your screenplay will be. You'll have copyrights to it for, you know, your life plus 70 years, which is kind of perpetuity. I mean,
but it runs out eventually.
Your concern.
All right, Catherine. Hey, I apologize to your agent. I was only kidding around. I don't want to get sued by your agent. It was only a joke. Catherine, thank you very much for the call. Terry in Manhattan. Hello, Terry.
Hi. I'm planning to self-publish a cookbook. And instead of using close-ups of food, I want to do still lives. The still lives could include part of a placemat, you know, with a plate over it, napkins, dish towels, objects of art, timers, vases, servers, plates. I assume I can't use copyrighted postcards in it, even if I use a section of them. Can you advise me on this?
You can use old postcards.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
But, you know, I can see a pretty big fair use argument. If it's a postcard of, you know, Atlantic City in 1957, I mean, it originally was to show what Atlantic City looked like in 1957. Then if you visited there, you'd send your postcard to your great aunt or something. But here it's sort of dolling up, dressing up a picture of food. I mean,
it's an accessory. It's not the main.
Yeah.
So I don't have to worry about it.
I wouldn't be too blatant about it, but, you know, I wouldn't lose any sleep over it either. I would go for the best photograph you can using everything you've got. And, you know, if you want someone to look it over before you.
I mean, a plate goes over most of it, so I'm just using, you know, basically a section of any of these items.
And I find it hard to believe that anybody would get, you know, too exercised about their stuff appearing in a self-published cookbook.
Not worth
you know,
doing.
It's just,
okay.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
Thanks, Terry.
So you think I'm pretty safe. The curious thing is that I look at all these cookbooks, and all the cookbooks are, you know, have close-ups of food.
Mm.
And it's so much more interesting if you do a little bit of a still life, like if you do deviled eggs and then you have beautiful colored eggs around it. So I was wondering, why doesn't anyone do that? And then I thought, well, it's probably because of copyright, but maybe it's just because it takes a lot of time.
Yeah, I think it's lazy, more laziness than anything else, probably.
Well, you had me at deviled eggs. I got to be honest with you. Terry, thanks a lot for the call. We appreciate it. Let's zip on over to Pittsfield. Susan, you're on. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a question regarding intellectual law, actually, on a federal level. And I was wondering if you have any information about current statutes regarding people taking personal information from your online accounts, selling it, using it in any other way, and or basically hacking into them, whether it's through an unsecured phone or online.
That's not a copyright issue.
Yeah, that's more of a privacy.
Well, you know,
go ahead, Paul.
Yeah.
You had said intellectual law, so that's why I was asking.
Yeah, well, that's not really, it's more of a privacy question than a copyright or a trademark question. So,
and it's criminal.
I mean, certainly, you know, yeah, certainly there are criminal statutes stopping people from hacking. There are laws, state and federal laws, that have to do with, you know, accessing personal information without your permission or consent. And those laws are particularly harsh if you're talking about children. But without knowing the particular situation, it's kind of hard to give you an answer. There are laws that, you know, the short answer is there's a body of law that will protect your information from being stolen or being misused.
Susan, thanks a lot for that one. Now we go to, let's see, line 8 and Fort Plain. Austin, you're on.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I am an independent musician. I have self-produced my own music album. It's mastered. It's ready to go. About a week and a half ago, I created a copyright.gov account to set about registering it, and I hit a brick wall the moment I was told that I could upload only 10 items. My album has 11 tracks. So I emailed the website there, and they told me they would get, or the form said they would get back to me in 5 business days. It's been much longer than that now. So I'm wondering what's going to happen to that 11th song. Do I have to register separately?
What you should do is register the work. Asks for the name of the work as the whole album. And then when it asks for the contents of the work, then you just list, you know, your 11 songs. And that ought to work.
There's no limit there.
No, not as far as I know.
Okay.
All right. Good luck.
In lieu of not hearing back from the office, I will gladly take your advice and proceed. Thank you for your time.
Thanks, Austin.
Good luck, and I hope it works.
All right. Let's now go. Let's see. We got a few minutes here. Michael in Amherst. Michael, you're up.
Hi. Thank you. I'm a photographer working on a book project of the Pioneer Valley. And my question is, if I were to utilize a phrase or a sentence from a famous poet who has probably been deceased for at least 50 to 100 years or more, and I give them attribution, is that an issue in terms of using something that I needed to find? I certainly can't find them, but I'm not quite sure who I would turn to get permission, or do I need permission?
Huh.
Well, if it was originally published before 1925, you don't need any permission at all. And if it's sufficiently short, I mean, you know, poets are quoted like this all the time. And, you know, you can just go online and put your little quote in, you'll probably get 100 hits. And I can almost guarantee you that none of them went and got permission for a short quote. The entire poem would be would be a different subject, okay. A different story. But, you know, if it's a line out of a poem and the poem's more than one line, you're probably going to be okay. If it's a contemporary poem, you might want to see about getting permission.
These wouldn't be contemporary.
Okay. And you should attribute it,
I appreciate your thoughts. Yeah. With that, I will attribute it.
Hey, Michael, you've been on this show before. You do fantastic work.
Yes,
thanks,
how are
man.
You, Ray?
Good, good.
I hope how you doing?
Everybody healthy over there?
Good to see you again.
Good.
They did. I feel good about what they said. Thanks,
all right, man.
Guys.
Yeah, you bet. Let's quickly, now we only have a minute or two. Mark in Albany. Mark, you're on.
Hi, I got a question for Paul Rapp. I go see these Grateful Dead bands, Dark Star Orchestra, Joe Russo's Dead Palace, big crowds, yep. Everyone loves it. They must make a lot of money. But people only come because they're playing Grateful Dead songs. So my question is, what kind of control does the Grateful Dead have over these bands? And do they get paid a bunch of money? How does that work?
They will get paid through ASCAP and BMI for the use of their compositions, or at least hypothetically. You know, venues pay licensing fees to ASCAP and BMI, who then send that money to the songwriters based on their monitoring of what songs get performed where in front of how many people. So yeah, the dead songwriters will get paid. The Grateful Dead, the band, probably not. But
yeah,
given the Grateful Dead's ethos about these sort of things, tape sharing and all the rest, I'm sure they're thrilled that there's bands out there keeping their legacy alive. So that all works out.
All right. Well, listen, done here. Oh, go ahead. Did you have something finally to say?
Yeah. I mean, you know, other artists don't feel the same way. I've had problems with the Frank Zappa estate on this, but Grateful Dead is not going to give you a problem for playing their songs out.
Well, listen,
celebrate it.
Paul Rapp and Polly Law, thank you both for being here. Hopefully next time we'll have you in the studio. We got our fingers crossed.
I hope so.
Yeah,
that'd be great.
Otherwise, Paul, at least answer our calls when we call you before the show.
Okay, we'll do.
All right, well, thanks both of you. Support comes from Stavros, helping people with disabilities to work toward their dreams. Offices in Amherst, Greenfield, and Springfield. Stavros.org for more information. C&H Architects, working with residential clients throughout the Berkshires and Hudson Valley to create a legacy of resilient architecture, passive house, net zero renovation, and new construction designed for the next 100 years. CNHArchitects.com. And the Albany Pine Bush Preserve, announcing opportunities to engage in conservation science online, offering lecture series webinars to observe local research and participate in scientific thinking. AlbanyPineBush.org. Thanks to Polly and Paul. Thanks to Zach, our engineer. Amber Sickles took the calls. Thanks to Rob Chacone for helping out in engineering. Tomorrow, BST Financial Advising with Jim Lozano and Judy Cahey. That's tomorrow at 2. Right now, it's The Book Show.